All right, thank you very much. So I'm going to tell you about entanglement and how it spreads in two-dimensional conformal field theory. This is work in progress that should appear very soon with Curtis Asplund, Alicia Bertolanti, and Federico Galli. So the sort of cartoon picture of the question that we want to ask is, if you take a pair of entangled particles, a Bell pair, and you send those two particles in opposite directions, send one this way and the other one that way, then how long do those particles remain maximally entangled like a Bell pair? So in a free theory, obviously the answer is forever. They just head out in opposite directions. And if, for example, you calculate the mutual information of some region way over here and some region way over here at late times, then you'll see a contribution from this entangled pair. But the question is, what happens at strong coupling in quantum field theory? And so presumably, in a system with interactions, entanglement spreads out. And what started out as a maximally entangled pair becomes some very complicated spread of quantum information throughout the system at late times. So the question is, how does this quantum information spread in a strongly coupled system far from equilibrium? So this is a general question that shows up in many different kinds of systems. It shows up in cold atoms experiments. We heard about it in many of the talks last week. Heard about it in many kinds of localization. It's certainly shows up a lot in gravity and black hole physics, and that's sort of what motivated what I'm going to talk about. But it's really just a talk about two-dimensional conformal field theory. Plus one CFT. And this single pair that I drew here is just a something to keep in mind. The actual types of states that I'll discuss are global quench states. So what I mean by this is states where at t equals zero, correlations are entirely short range. So there's a correlation like C, and everything is exponentially dying off at scales greater than C. But it's a state with, so this is a state with, it's a translation invariant state with finite energy density, and correlations start off short range, but then they're going to spread. And in a relativistic system, spread at most at speed one, at the speed of light. And presumably, at late times, if the theory is not integrable, the state will thermalize and be basically indistinguishable from a thermal state.
Question?
Yeah.
So probably you also want to say that the initial state has very low entanglement. Because as we learned from Matt Hastings' talk last week, that
yes, good.
Correlation functions don't.
That's right. Yes. So the correlations are dying off, but entanglement is also dying off. So there's a divergent contribution from. So we're in. If we look at say a single interval on the line, this is our region A. Then there's the usual UV term from the boundaries, but there's no volume term. There's no term proportional to length in this initial state. So it's
That's
short range entangled too.
There's not a typical finite energy density state.
Yeah, that's right.
Absolutely not, yeah.
So what does the energy have to do with it, really?
Since it's translation invariant, it has some energy density, and it's going to thermalize at the temperature given by that energy density.
So basically, it's a special finite energy state, which is the ground state of another massive system.
Yeah, so that's why they're called quench states. So one way to get a state like this is to start in a gap Hamiltonian, find the ground state, and then suddenly change your Hamiltonian. So we're going to evolve under a CFT Hamiltonian starting at t equals zero.
So that C has nothing to do with the temperature. That the correlation functions will also do that at all times.
Because it's now a CFT.
Yeah, but it's screened by finite temperature, isn't it? Because you're making
correlations. Okay, but the entanglement.
The entanglement
spread out.
Yes, that's right.
I should have just said the entanglement. I'm not even going to talk about correlations.
Do you have to make sure to change the Hamiltonian in a smooth way to prevent the state from becoming irregular?
So what I have in mind is we just have a wave function. I'm not sure what happens if you do this dynamically. I'm just imagining that you give me a wave function that you got from some other Hamiltonian, and I'm going to evolve that under my CFT Hamiltonian. If you do this dynamically, there are other issues, and that may actually itself introduce some energy into the system, and I don't want to talk about that.
Can you express the same problem in terms of wave functions, where you could say the wave function and say, and the wave function in the free vacuum is generally infinitely different from the wave function in the reacting vacuum? Axiomatically and say, I have a state with all these properties.
Well, I'm going to model this. I'm going to get into the details of how I model the state a little bit later. I'm just trying to give a general picture, so let me get through that, and then we can come back to this. What we think is going to happen in this state is that stuff is going to spread out, and eventually it's going to look thermal. Basically, what you've done is you've dumped a bunch of uncorrelated energy into this initial state, and you want to watch what happens. So if you do this in a free theory, and calculate the entanglement entropy as a function of time for some fixed region A. So what's going to happen, it's basically like this picture of the Bell pair. So at t equals 0, this state has a bunch of short-range entangled stuff. Think of C as being small. So here's some entangled pairs. And they're going to head out in opposite directions. Okay, there are lots of these. I'm always going to talk about system sizes that are much greater than this initial correlation length. So you can think of there being lots of these pairs within any region that I'll talk about. Then we can tell from looking at this picture what's going to happen to the entanglement entropy. So let's call this region A.
Sorry, Tom, I know this is a cartoon that people like to make, but is it really a good representation of the ground state of the gap? You know, you could have a mass and then turn off the mass, and would it actually look like that? You know, a bunch of pairs?
I think it will in a free theory.
In the free theory?
Yeah.
As long as the gap is large, yeah, that's fine.
Yeah.
You can do this all explicitly, completely explicitly.
Okay, so this is my region A here is length L, much greater than the initial correlation length. So what does the entanglement entropy of region A look like as a function of time? Well, I'm only going to keep track of the volume term. So there's a divergent term, which is independent of time. I'm always going to ignore that term. So we'll just keep track of the volume term. It starts out at 0. That's more or less our starting point for the kinds of states we want to look at. There's no volume term at t equals 0. It's going to grow linearly as these entangled pairs spread out. So like this particle here sitting in region A is entangled with this one over here outside of region A. So that contributes to the entanglement entropy. And the longer we wait, the more time these pairs will have to spread out. So you can just count them and see how fast this is growing, and you'll find that it's growing linearly. But at time L over 2, all of the particles sitting in region A are going to be entangled with some particle on the outside. So at that point, it can't grow anymore, and it saturates. So if I actually, let me plot SA over the thermal entropy density. So this is the thermal entropy density at the energy beta corresponding to the amount of energy we dumped into the initial state. So beta is basically the up to a constant, the correlation length C. Okay, so after at the time where it saturates, the entanglement entropy is just going to be the size of the region times the thermal entropy density. It's going to saturate at the thermal value of the entanglement entropy. Okay, so grows linearly until it reaches the thermal value, saturates, and it's straight. So Hardy and Calabrese did a similar calculation in two-dimensional conformal field theory. So what I've drawn here is a cartoon for the free boson, but they did this calculation in conformal field theory, interacting conformal field theory. And what they found is that the entanglement entropy in any CFT is given by the central charge of the CFT, times the answer for the free boson. So it's completely universal. It's determined only by the central charge, which we know is a measure of degrees of freedom, times the free boson answer.
Does this still apply if it's a circle rather than a unit line?
I don't think so.
You mean the target space, or
the space? Yeah.
There could be other features in this.
Whether this proportionality is still true.
No, it's true for only true for this picture that I've drawn here. Well, part of the question is to what extent it's true.
The Gress features.
Yeah, so it's true up to some non-universal stuff here and here.
What I mean is that if the space is finite size, for free case, the entropy will drop again because the pairs meet each other.
Yeah, the answer is that won't be universal to every CFT, and that's actually sort of related to the question I'm going to ask in this talk.
Okay,
so it's universal up to some non-universal behavior, sort of rounding out these corners. What's universal is the leading behavior as you take all of your scales much greater than the corresponding temperature that were the initial correlation length. So in the leading behavior of this limit is given exactly by C times the free boson answer.
So does it saturate at the thermal entropy density times L over 2, you know, for whatever the interacting CFT is?
It does. So that.
I don't see why that is necessarily C times the.
Yeah, so the thermal entropy density in CFT is C over beta. So so the thermal entropy density in a CFT is also C times the thermal entropy density of a free boson.
Size is much bigger than a cup.
Well, right? Yeah, that's.
Yes, that's right.
Okay. That's the extensive.
Yeah, it's really CFT.
That's the hardest.
Okay, so this is true. You can get the right answer by modeling this as if entanglement were carried by freely moving quasi-particles created at t equals zero that just propagate ballistically. They're just created at t equals zero and they head out in both directions. And we get the right answer if we model this by just pretending that the entanglement doesn't spread. And it just is carried by these free particles. Yeah.
Sorry, Jim, just to clarify. So there's some rounding out which depends on which CFT you're in.
Yes, that's right.
And whose width is beta, or is proportional to beta?
Yes. That's
Is there, were you making a claim that for a free CFT it's perfectly sharp? Did you make that claim? Or?
Oh, no, I didn't
oh, okay.
make that claim. Okay, so that's completely universal. Now, for a more fine-grained picture of what's happening to this information, so it's completely universal, but we'd expect that information should sort of spread out in interacting theory. And I think to get a more fine-grained picture for how information spreads, the next thing to look at is the entanglement entropy of disjoint regions, or the mutual information of separated regions. So this is like some multi-party version of this question. So the one I'm going to focus on is two intervals after a global quench. So the setup is the following. We have region A.
So Tom, you talk about temperature, but a CFT doesn't actually thermalize. Is that important? It doesn't have to fully thermalize.
It doesn't
For example, the free boson, there's no reason it should have a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution and its excitations.
Yeah, that's right. So the states that I'll talk about, the states that Cardi and Calabrese picked turn out to thermalize. And I'll also be talking about theories that do thermalize. But yeah, I should say that this picture and this answer is specific to a particular state that models the quench, which I'll talk about a little bit later.
Sorry, but actually you only need a I mean, do you really need the entropy to be exactly the thermal entropy? Is it like slightly below that, or only reach the thermal entropy in high temperature limit?
So you mean in saturation, or?
Yeah. I just mean following Joe's question, like if it doesn't really thermalize, then maybe the entropy is slightly below the thermal entropy.
Yeah, if it's not, this isn't a particular state, which I'll write on the board a little later. And it would be different in a non-integrable, in an integrable theory, you can set up a state with those properties that doesn't do this.
But then, so the chiral operators in the CFT just to the left and right. So I wouldn't expect those to ever thermalize in any CFT.
Good. I will be addressing that question. So to what extent do CFTs have chiral operators? That's kind of part of the question.
Right.
Okay, so the situation that I'll take throughout the talk is two regions of size L. They could be different sizes. I'll just always take them to size L to keep things simple, and separated by a distance big D. With D greater than L, again, that's not essential, but keep things simple. And always in this scaling limit where T, D, and L are much greater than the initial correlation.
Sorry, beta is the initial correlation. I'm going to ask this question again, because I keep saying it. Beta is the final temperature or the initial correlation?
Both.
Are those necessarily equal?
Well,
no.
They're proportional. They are proportional. In the state. I'm talking about a particular, yeah. When I write the state, it'll be obvious why these are the same.
So for vacuum theory, in the system, we locally thermalize first. And then when you enter the linear state, you already have the same thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you locally already thermalized.
What does locally? What does locally thermalize?
Yeah, just say the locally you can apply thermodynamics. Say the locally hydrodynamic already applies. So that time scale is beta. And this only applies when the time is greater than beta.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
That's beta already exists.
Yeah, there's some rise that Hong talked about last week here. But I haven't drawn it because beta's small.
I mean, you understand, right? The thing that's confusing me is that C is just a property of the initial state, but the final beta depends on the Hamiltonian.
But it's a CFT.
Logically,
it's a CFT. But you can put in whatever initial state you want, right?
The energy is conserved. Yeah.
No, but it doesn't matter. I mean,
the state is characterized by one dimensional.
By the time, when you There's by only the time one where you reach the linear stage, C has already been forgotten.
I agree one is a function of the other. That's the one is a linear function of the other because it's a CFT.
I apologize for not writing the state earlier. I will write it. Let's hold off on this. Let's keep going.
This state has arbitrary dimensionless parameters.
Okay, so first let's use the quasi-particle picture to calculate the entanglement entropy of the joint interval SAB. So what's going to happen? Well, first, at early times, these are far away. So it's just going to be the same as we had for the single interval. It's just going to go up linearly. It's going up with a slope that's twice as big now because there are two intervals, and it's going to saturate at 2L. Okay, so at time L over 2, it saturates. Now in a free theory, remember we've created these pairs everywhere. And in a free theory, the pairs that we created in the middle are heading out in the two directions. And at some point, the entangled pair is going to have one guy in region A and the other one in region B. When that happens, the entanglement entropy goes down. Because it's not measuring the entanglement of A with B, it's measuring the entanglement of AB with everything else. So when that entangled pair enters these two regions, the entanglement entropy goes down. So this dip starts at d over 2. And it continues until d over 2 plus l. So this dip is occurring when the particles created in the middle are sitting in regions AB. But then they pass through. The dip goes away. OK?
You probably said it, but can you define SAB?
SAB is the entanglement entropy of the reduced density matrix on the region A union B. Some people would rather think about the mutual information. If we plot the mutual information of A and B, which is SA plus SB minus SAB, then it's the volume. I'm only plotting the volume term as always. It's going to be 0 when no particles are in the two. Can everyone see this, actually? It's going to be 0. And then when we get to the part where they're in the two regions, there's going to be a peak. And then it's 0 again. OK, so the mutual information is just seeing that those pairs are now correlated when they're in the two regions.
Excuse me. So could you remind me that why you are interested in the situation where D is larger than L?
It's just a choice so that I don't have to keep saying the two different. It doesn't change very much. Okay. Just makes it easier for me to say the results. But
this time dependence could be different.
Yeah, it's a little more complicated because this one sort of joins with this one, and you have to worry about both together. And
Well, just for simplicity. Just for simplicity.
Yes. Okay, so this dip basically says that entanglement, this is what I'll say is the no scrambling answer. It says that when you create an entangled pair, it stays maximally entangled forever. You know, we could put these two regions 100 light years apart, wait for 50 years, and we would still see this peak in the mutual information at late times, right? So this is the fact that the entanglement is not in any sense spreading over the system. Under time evolution. Okay, so this is correct in the free boson, and Cardi and Calabrese showed that under certain assumptions about correlation functions in conformal field theory that I'll talk about, that this would actually be true about any conformal field theory. Now that's surprising. Well, depending on your point of view. It's surprising because this is a strongly coupled system. And we would expect this information to sort of leak into the rest of the system. It's also surprising because you can calculate this holographically. And in holographic theories, where the entanglement entropy is given by the Ryu-Takanagi or HRT formula, you don't see any kind of memory effects like this at late time. So holography suggests that at large central charge, which is the holographic limit, there should at least be some theories, dual to gravity, where entanglement is maximally scrambled.
Yeah, so in the free bosons, what parameter sets the depth of the well?
So it's actually always a factor of two. Basically, because at the depth of the well, you have all of the right movers in here are entangled with all of the left movers in here. Mm-hmm. So basically, it's half as entangled. It's half disentangled.
But does this feature, and this feature you're claiming depends on it being free, or in the conjecture that was made, it was also half?
That was also half, yeah. OK, so the goal was to understand, to sort of revisit this issue and understand exactly in what theories entanglement scrambles and in what theories it doesn't. So I'm going to first write down the claims and some caveats to come. So these are we haven't calculated the entanglement entropy in the most general possible CFT, but I'll give what I think is good evidence for these claims. So I'm going to state the claims assuming that the stress tensor and its descendants are the only currents, only conserved currents in the theory. And then I'll give the modified claim when you have extended symmetry. But if the stress tensor, in other words, if you only have Virasoro symmetry in this CFT and no extended chiral algebra, then the answer depends qualitatively on the central charge. So for C less than or equal to 1, you get exactly the quasi-particle answer. So with only Virasoro symmetry, the quasi-particle answer works for the minimal models, and it also works for so the minimal models are rational CFTs, but it also works at the borderline. So this is a less than or equal to 1. So it works for the irrational boson, for example, as well. This is sort of an almost rational, irrational but integrable CFT. For C goes to infinity, you get the holographic behavior. So this is a CFT calculation, not assuming holography, but it is assuming some properties of the CFT, which I can get into a little later. And then for 1 less than C, less than infinity, it's somewhere in between, and actually it's not universal. So we can't calculate it. I'm not sure what it looks like. Presumably it falls somewhere in between, but we don't actually have an example where we've managed to exactly calculate it.
But not universal means it depends on more than C.
That's right.
Even qualitatively.
Yes. As far as we can tell, although we can't calculate it, so
there could be some magic.
Yeah. It seems to not be universal.
The holographic answer does not depend on the state.
It depends on how we model this state. So that's one of my caveats. So the caveats for these claims, first of all, that we have to model this quench somehow. And I'll talk about two different models. One is the Cardi-Calabrese model, which is a boundary state in conformal field theory. The other is a thermal double model, which, for reasons that I'll show you, the answer is probably the same, but hasn't been proved. And the other caveat is that some of these statements are definitely true for the second Rennie, probably true for the other Rennies, and it's hard to do the analytic continuation to n equals 1. So we can't conclusively calculate the von Neumann entropy, but this is definitely the picture for the second Rennie, and seems to be true for all the Rennies.
So if the CFD is described by correction of n free bosons, then that n is very large, then does it give a holographic answer?
No. So this is there's an extra assumption here, which is that the theory has a sparse low-lying spectrum, and that's what gives you the holographic type behavior. Instead of the free boson.
So when you say C goes to infinity, you mean C goes to infinity and we look at only the leading order term with C?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, so I was going to ask, so there is an order one dip, right?
Yeah, there is.
The holographic.
Yeah.
But even the holographic one has that dip.
In the holographic one, this size is C.
Yeah.
Which is very big,
yeah.
And there's a little dip, which is order one here.
Yeah. So it's really plus order, okay.
The leading behavior is C, right? Yeah.
Well, I've divided out by, sorry, this was supposed to be over S normal. There we go.
But to capture the dip, do you have to do a loop correction, or is it already at the classical gravity level?
The order one dip in gravity is basically coming from the fields in the bulk that have some mutual information because they're propagating like free fields.
So it's related to bulk entanglement, bulk quantum field entanglement.
Yes. Or at least that's one contribution. I don't know if that's the only, I think that's the only contribution. Yeah. At leading
order. But we don't know, it's a conjecture.
Okay.
Well,
it's
a reasonable one. It's a reasonable conjecture.
Okay. Yeah.
Going back to this question, which I was asked about, if I like, say, three free bosons, the last case, that's between C, say, between 1 to infinity, again, I expect it to be the same as the first case.
Yeah, so this C free bosons has lots of extra symmetries.
Right.
So let me now state the claim in the presence of extra symmetries.
They argued that was in a static case.
So if you have lots of symmetries in a conformal field theory, then you have some exponential growth in conserved currents at high energy. So let me define the density of currents. It's just the density of states, but only counting the states that correspond to conserved currents. You can define from this an effective central charge. The energy goes to infinity. So what I'm doing is I'm counting a current means a state with conformal weights L0 bar equals 0 comma E. And I'm counting states at this time. And the reason I've defined C currents this way is because if we counted all states, then the asymptotic density of states would behave like this, but with the ordinary central charge here. So I'm just defining C currents in a way that it counts only the conserved currents of the theory, as opposed to counting all the states of the theory at high energies. Then the quasiparticle picture works. If and only if C currents is equal to the actual central charge of the theory.
So you mean when the C goes to infinity in this holographic series, the C current stays finite?
In holographic theories, it does. That's correct. If you took the C free bosons, then it wouldn't. Yeah.
So this means your sparseness condition is stronger than the normal sparseness condition.
No. Well, I'm not going to specify exactly what the sparseness condition is, but C currents.
Are you allowing other low-lying operators?
Yes. I'm allowing other low-lying operators. I'm just talking about the conserved currents here.
I didn't hear him call that a sparseness condition.
This is not a sparseness condition. No, this is not a sparseness condition. So if you take any theory with some central charge, five, and it only has zero supersymmetry, then C currents will be 1. And C will be 5. So sparseness condition is something that makes sense in the large C limit. This is something that makes sense for any value of C. So if you just have this, roughly speaking, C currents counts the number of conserved currents. So the stress tensor contributes 1 to this. Unless you're in a middle model, then you have null states, and it contributes something less than 1. But for any C greater than 1, the stress tensor contributes 1 to this. So that becomes this statement over here.
Are you going to assume some gap on the operators with, let's say, a very small value of L0 and close to being a conserved current?
No, I don't have to do that, but only because I think if you have lots of, say you take a million conserved currents and you make them not quite conserved by giving them a very small L0, then I think you'll just get something very close to this, but it will be measurably different from the quasi-particle answer. The slope will not be quite 1. Okay, so now I'm gonna, question.
Yes. Question. Is it that are you making a differentiation between when the dip depends on L and when it doesn't? So could you think of your order 1 in the holographic as L independent? It's not.
No, actually in the holographic, the order 1 dip is still, it still depends on L, but it just has a smaller height.
So in all cases, it will depend on L. That's.
Sorry, Tom. But, I mean, if I just do something stupid, like I have some pure pseudo-R theory and I just throw in a few minimal models for fun, then won't it still be quasi-particle?
Yes, and you'll always...
But C won't be equal to C currents, will it?
What's your example again?
I just take the product of two theories, right? That you just can, two theories that don't interact with each other.
And the stress tensors are separately conserved.
The stress tensors are separately conserved. Oh, I see. So you still see it'll be equal to C current.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so I'm going to tell you now about how we do these calculations. So we use the method of Fardy and Calabrese. So I'll start with the replica trick for the single interval, and then say how things change in our case. Okay, so what we actually compute are Rennie entropies, 1 over 1 minus n, log, trace rho I to the n. So for a single interval in vacuum, this calculation was done by Holgi, Larson, and Wilczek, and Cardi and Calabrese. So, the way this works is that you calculate these replica partition functions, trace of rho to the n, using by gluing together many copies of the system. So here's the Euclidean plane for a two-dimensional CFT. And the way you calculate trace of rho to the n is to take your region A and glue together n copies of this glued along the cup. So one way to think of that is as an n-sheeted version of this picture. Another way to think of that is as a correlation function where you insert what are called twist operators at the endpoints of the interval. So this is these twist operators sit at the endpoints of the region, and the twist operators are defined to make this equation true. Okay, so the twist operators are defined to make to reproduce the partition function on this multi-sheeted cut plane.
So if we just had the ordinary theory, would the twist operators be present in the operator?
No, so they're not local operators in the theory that we started with. There are various ways to think about them. I like to think about them as local operators in you can think of them as non-local operators in that theory that are just defined by this. Or you can think of them as local operators in an orbifold of the full CFT that you get by adding twist operators to the original CFT. okay, so the only thing we need to know about these twist operators is their scaling dimension, because two-point functions in vacuum are fixed by scaling dimensions. And so that was found to be C over 12 and minus 1 over n for the nth Reni. So if you plug this scaling dimension into this two-point function, then you get the famous answer for the Renis. And if you take n to 1, you get the C over 3 log L for the entanglement entropy. So this is a Euclidean picture that I've drawn here. We could, well, in vacuum, it doesn't much matter. But if we wanted the Lorentzian answer, say for some boosted intervals, we could get that by first calculating the Euclidean answer and then analytically continuing to Lorentzian signature. So that's one interval in vacuum. The problem that we want to look at is two intervals in the quench. So the model of the quench that was introduced by Cardi and Calabrese was that the initial state is the following. So B here is a conformal boundary state. The conformal boundary state is what you get by putting a boundary condition on your path integral. And it's not a normalizable state. It has only infinitely short-range correlations, so it's basically infinite energy. But by evolving in Euclidean time, you can smooth out the UV of this non-normalizable state. And what that does is it smooths it out and gives it a correlation length beta, or beta over 2. And gives you a normalizable state. Okay, so this is the initial state for the quench. T equals 0. So this has all the properties that I mentioned at the beginning in talking about quenches. It's translation invariant. It has some finite energy density, and it has only short range entanglement.
And it evolves something that looks like a thermal state?
It does, actually, even in the minimal models, which is, I would say, an artifact, maybe, of taking this particularly simple operator to put here, to Not every state will do that, but it does.
Is that easy to see that it does that? Is it a calculation?
Easy? No, I don't think it's extremely easy. John?
No, you can show that the reduced density matrix of any interval gets exponentially close to a thermal one.
In this particular state?
In this particular
state. Yeah, okay,
state.
Yeah.
Maybe an intuition is that if I look at the entanglement between left mover and right mover in that state, it's thermal. The reduced density matrix is thermal. And then when you do the quench time evolution, left and right in the same region got decoupled. So when you look them together, it's still thermal.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So in the replica trick, we're supposed to calculate trace of rho A to the N in this state. Okay, so I said the state was created by putting a boundary condition. So the calculation of rho A to the N in this state turns out to be the following. So this involves some conformal mappings that I'm not going to tell you about, but here's the picture at the end of the day. So it's a path integral on the upper half plane with boundary condition B along the real line, and twist operators inserted like this. So these are sigma plus, sigma minus, sigma plus, sigma minus. Okay. So basically, this came from starting with a path integral on a strip that had a B at the top and bottom, and then doing some exponential mapping to this picture here. So all we need to do is calculate this four-point function of twist operators in the upper half plane. This is not so easy. A helpful first step is the method of images. So the method of images, sort of, that's this squiggle here, sort of relates this four-point function in the upper half plane to an eight-point function in the full plane. So this is the full plane now, and we have our original points, and then we put image points in the lower half plane. So I'm going to label these points W1, W2, W3, W4, W1 bar, W2 bar, W3 bar,
W4 bar. Remind me why these things are tilted.
Are tilted?
Yeah.
Because we actually calculate an expectation value in the state B, and that's not this picture. That would be on a strip with B at the top and bottom, but there's a conformal mapping that takes that to this picture, and in the process it tilts the intervals. Okay, so. The conformal transformation, so this tilde, I don't really have time to go into the details of this tilde, but these are not equal. The correlation function in the upper half plane is not equal to this eight-point function correlator of twist operators. They have the same conformal transformation properties. They have the same singularities in limits where these come together. But they're not actually equal. And one of the caveats that I mentioned for these results is that what I'm actually going to use is this eight-point function. This is the thing that I'm actually going to calculate. You could think of this as a bad way of doing this calculation, or you could think of it just as a different model for the quench. So. These image points have calculating this correlator with the image points has a natural physical interpretation in the thermal double. So basically, these image points are regions in a thermal double CFT that purifies. It's already a pure state. Let me draw a picture.
to explain what I mean by this. The image points are like points in the Hubble double. So this is a different model for the quench, where you start with your CFT that has regions A and B, and you double it by adding an identical CFT with identical regions A and B. And then you put them in the entangled state that corresponds to a thermal state of one of them. So if you take this thermal double state and you evolve it under the Hamiltonian, that the thermal double state basically has short-range correlations that entangle a pair with one guy in here and one guy in there. And if you evolve this under a Hamiltonian that sends these guys that direction and those guys that direction, you get a slightly different model for this quench. It has a quasi-particle picture, just like the original model for the quench, and for single intervals gives exactly the same answer.
Sorry, but compared to the original quench, this has twice the degree of freedom, twice my name.
Yeah, that's right. So when I say it gives the same answer, I mean you have to divide by two at the end of the day.
Sorry, so this is not equivalent to just putting it in the thermal. If I just study the first CFT and...
So when I say we calculate the entanglement entropy now, the region involves both CFTs. If we were to calculate, if we were to take define regions only in CFT1, that would just give us thermal answers.
Oh, I see.
But by keeping the regions over here too, we get quench, like we get the quench answers. Okay, and for anyone who's keeping track, this is also the starting point for a simple holographic model of the quench, since the thermal field double is dual to the eternal black hole, and you can think of these as being regions on the two sides of the Penrose diagram. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I think you said this and I missed it, but so for the single interval, the boundary and the thermal field, the boundary state and the thermal field double give the same answer, and for the two intervals, they're different, and you can only compute the thermal field answer.
That's correct.
Why? Is there an easy way to see why they're different?
Well, for example, in the boundary state, they could depend on the boundary condition. I mean, the things that have to agree are singularities, and I'm about to explain why the singularities in this situation are very subtle. So, I think what I'll say is true about this state as well, because I don't think that this state. So, what I'm going to talk about is the singularities of this eight-point function, and that's what fixes all these claims I made. I don't think that this state can have any singularities not already present in this picture, but haven't proved that. If that's true, then everything I say is also true about this.
They could agree, so possibly.
I think that the universal behavior of these things do agree, but haven't proved it.
So you can choose a particular boundary condition, which is a quotient of that thermal state.
Uh-huh.
Take the symmetric sector of the two.
Let's see. So you're suggesting that this is a particular example of this.
After you quotient the z2.
After you quotient. Yes, that's right. I haven't thought about whether that's a totally exact statement for what I'm going to say, but I think that sounds right.
I mean, you would need to do a sum over a boundary.
Yeah.
This is a special boundary state. It's a circulation of a different boundary condition.
Tom, as you know, the four-point function with the boundary is the eight-point function of a chiral theory. I'm sure that you're going to mention that, I hope. But it's not the eight-point function.
It's not
the eight-point function with both the holomorphic and the
yes.
anti-holomorphic.
Absolutely. No, I wasn't. I'm going to.
Eight-point function of a chiral theory.
Of a chiral theory, but yes, that's right.
Right.
But
well, in a sense.
In a sense.
Then.
Yes.
In a sense.
What is this?
Okay. I think I don't have time to get into the the technicalities. Let me tell you why this picture gives the behavior that I described for the these memory effects in the mutual information. Okay, so this is an 8-point function, and we can't, in general, hope to compute 8-point functions. They're not universal, but what helps us is this limit that T, L, and D are much greater than beta. So it turns out in this limit, this forces you into special configurations of these 8 points where some of the WIs approach some of the other WIs. And that's a limit that we know how to calculate. So at early times, so I should have kept, let me draw back the picture of the answer we're looking for here. So at early times, when the entanglement entropy is supposed to be rising linearly, if you look at this configuration of 8 points, what you find is that everyone's approaching its image point. So W1 is approaching W1 bar, W2 is approaching W2 bar, and so on. Everyone's approaching its image point. And we know the singularity as W1 approaches W1 bar. You just get a W1 minus W1 bar to this minus scaling function. So if you just plug in these leading singularities in this limit, then calculate the corresponding entanglement entropy, you get the linear rise. If you do the same thing at late or intermediate times, where I just mean any time that stays away from the dip, if you look at the kinematics of these 8 points, but stay away from the dip, then you find that they're coming together this way now. So like W1 is going to W2, W3 is going to W4, 1 bar is going to 2 bar, 3 bar to 4 bar. So again, you get some nice set of just leading singularities of these 8 points, of these 4 points approaching 4 other points. We know how the operators behave in this limit. It's fixed by conformal invariance. And if you plug that in, you get the thermal value, thermal saturation. Time corresponding to the dip on that figure, which is t between d over 2 and d over 2 plus l, then you find something funny. So what you find is that W1 is approaching W2. Okay, so it seems like we're in business. But then W1 bar is approaching W3. Okay, similar things happen to the other points. So remember, in the quench, we're going to Lorentzian signature. And W and W bar are just independent numbers. So they're allowed to do this. We can have the W1 doing different things from W1 bar. And what that means is that this diagram sort of doesn't know which channel. It can't decide which channel to be. The right movers want to be in sort of this channel where these points come together. The left movers want to be in some channel like this. And in a general conformal field theory, we don't know the behavior of the correlator in that limit. So in general, correlators in this limit are not fixed by the OPE. In a free theory, you can treat the left and right movers completely independently. So you can just treat the W's and the W bars as if they were totally independent coordinates, and you can do the OPE separately on left and right movers. So in a free theory, you would get a singularity minus like this, W1 minus W2 times W1 bar minus W3, etc., for all the other points. And if you assume that there's a singularity like that, then indeed you get back the quasi-particle dip. So the quasi-particle dip is coming if and only if these funny singularities are present in the correlation function. Yeah.
I know it's not direct, but is there any interpretation in the free case where you do have this quasi-particle picture of what's coming closer and who's sharing singlets?
Well, only if you think of, there is, if you allow yourself to think of W and W bar as going in different channels, which is allowed in a free theory. And actually, it's also allowed in a rational theory. So this is why the rational theories are going to have exactly the quasi-particle answer. Right. Okay. And if you have a holographic picture in mind, then each OPE limit corresponds to a choice of Ryu Takanagi surface. So if you're thinking holographically, then at early times you want to draw Ryu Takanagi surfaces that connect across the images. These go through the black hole. At late times, you want to connect things like this. But during the dip regime, there's competition. And you can't connect half the line across and half the line. There's not a new configuration of Ryu Takanagi line, of HRT lines that you can draw in this case. Because you have to pick. You can't treat W and W bar independently in that case.
So you get no dip at all.
That's right. So in that case, you get no dip at all. OK, I'll just be 2 more minutes. I want to tell you why this has to do with the spectrum, or how we can directly relate this to the spectrum of conserved currents. So now that we've identified the physics of the dip as coming from these funny singularities, so I should explain what these singularities are. So these are light cone singularities. These are what happen in Lorentzian signature. If you take the simplest way you can get singularities like this is with 3 points. If you have 3 points, and you put the third, and you put one way up into the tip of this light cone, that gives you this kind of singularity. So the strange limits of the correlation function. That's what's happening in the dip. So the way we can relate this to the spectrum is by looking at the second rank. So we've isolated that the physics of the dip, the physics responsible for this dip, if it's there, comes from these 4 points becoming light-like separated, null separated, and something similar happening for these. But if all we care about is the singularity in that limit, we can ignore the other points. Okay? So this is how we're going to relate it to the spectrum. So once we've ignored the other points, this is now a 4-point function. 4-point functions are a lot easier than 8-point functions. Four-point functions are functions of a single cross ratio. And if you look at the dip regime, this cross ratio is trying to do the following. It's trying to send x to 0 and x bar to 1. So the example that we can compute in total detail is the second Rennie, s n equals 2. So for n equals 2, if you have 2 intervals with double twist operators, that's topologically a torus. So okay, if you kind of convince yourself, kind of stare at where all the cycles go as you try to go around the 2 sheets of this picture, then you convince yourself that it has 2 cycles, so this is a torus. And in conformal field theory, we can map that to an ordinary torus. So this relates the second Reni to the torus partition function. So this goes back to papers by Lunin and Latour and Matt Hedrick. The upshot being that if you know the torus partition function, then you can calculate the second Reni of two intervals. So that relates this question of light cone singularities to a question about the spectrum. The question you end up asking about the spectrum, if you want to know about these particular light cone singularities, so we have this torus partition function. You think of this in terms of temperatures, then these light cone singularities correspond to funny temperature limits of this partition function. They correspond to a mixed temperature limit where you take the left moving temperature to zero and the right moving temperature to infinity. So what does that do? It projects the left moving sector onto the ground state and asks about the asymptotics in the right moving sector. So, so this is determined by states with conformal weights L0, L0 bar, which are delta dimension plus or minus spin, over two, equals 0, comma beta. Okay, so that's why the singularities in these twist correlation functions are related to this simple property of the spectrum. And this observation gives you back, this observation is what gives you all the claims that I made at the beginning about the relation between the spectrum and the quasi-particle-like behavior of entanglement entropy. So as you can see, some of those are claims about the second Reni.
From the point of view, these are super-rotating. If you tried to write, these would not be black holes, they would be...
E equals J.
It's E equals J is too big. E is bigger, J is bigger than E by something. So these violate cosmic censorship.
Yes, they would. If there were such black holes, they would violate cosmic censorship. They have left moving, you're shifting by C over 24, right. And this is not shifted, so that's why.
Oh, okay.
Sorry, so this is not the extremal black hole.
No, it's not. So the black holes start at there's a gap to the black holes, and the gap exists in both left and right moving dimensions. So they start at, the black holes would start at C over 24, comma C over 24 in this normalization I'm using. And a very heavy extremal black hole would have C over 24, comma big, whereas we're talking about 0, comma big.
But don't extremal black holes have left-moving temperature 0? Isn't that the important thing?
They do. So they will contribute.
Do you need L0 equals 0, or you just need the minimum value of L0 there is in that sector?
That will give you the answer.
Yeah.
But it won't give you the quasi-particle answer. So. That'll give you a different singularity in that limit, and it's probably the right singularity in holographic theory, but it's not the quasi-particle answer. Okay, so I'm way out of time, so I'll just mention a couple comments and I'm done. The first is C equals going C to infinity, so there's a long story here, but the upshot is that with some extra assumptions about the sparse spectrum, same CFT calculation that I've described gives back the maximal scrambling. So the gravity answer. And a couple of questions. One is, what is the simplest example of a theory like the ones I'm talking about? Okay, I've been talking about theories that have central charge greater than, say we only have Virasoro. Theories with C greater than 1, but no extra conserved currents. The only examples I actually know of for sure are sigma models on Calabi-Yaus. Okay, this can't possibly be the simplest example of such a theory. Maybe someone in the audience knows of one. If you do, please come tell me, or tell me right now. My guess would be if you take a few scalar fields in two dimensions, and you give them a more or less random quartic potential, say, that they'll flow to a fixed point of this type. But I don't know. Maybe someone knows.
But you just take an orbifold of something with a bunch of random orbifold of something with a bunch of scalar, a bunch of free scalars.
Yeah. So that's well. So the
it's an example of Calabi-Yau in some sense.
The orbifold is not quite. So it needs to be a supersymmetric orbifold, because you need to have the marginal deformation. So if you take an actual symmetric orbifold, which is like a stringy limit of ADS CFT, but maybe small n, doesn't matter. That actually has a quasi-particle behavior. So like if you take the symmetric product of some bosons, that will have quasi-particle behavior. You really need to deform the theory away from the symmetric orbifold. And if you want to do that and still have a CFT, the only examples I know of have lots of supersymmetry. So I don't know of a non-supersymmetric way you can do that. Okay, maybe someone knows. I think the other interesting question is here is what's the rate? So I really only talked about very late times, but a more detailed question is how fast does entanglement scramble, especially in light of various bounds that black holes give, fast scramblers, maximal chaos, and so on. You could wonder if there's something really interesting going on with the rate. Okay, thanks very much.
Couple of questions. Am I sharing this? Yeah.
If I consider holographic theories and if the boundaries are 2 plus 1D, so just one high dimension, I would have thought that you would not see a dip even away from n is equal to infinity, even at finite. Is there 1 over n dip?
You're saying holographic theories?
Yeah.
Holographic theories will always have the 1 over n dip, just because what it comes from is the fact that there's free fields in the bulk. Mm-hmm. And their mutual information contributes at order 1 over n to the mutual information of the CFT.
But if I consider it as a generic system, I don't expect that. Anything, like this room or something. I mean.
And there's something special about holographic theories. Right. They're slightly freer than totally
right.
Unfree
right.
theories.
But you agree that most theories I don't expect.
A
generic system in.
Yeah, I think I agree with that, yeah.
But even in the holographic case, is that order one dip, I mean, isn't it small in the strict limit you wrote down where all your link scales are large compared to beta?
Well, you have to worry about C and L now because you're taking two limits.
Yeah.
I mean, no, it's not. If you only ask about the volume scaling, so let's talk about the volume term. So it's always scaling with L, but then we can organize that as an expansion in C. And there's a volume term that's order C coming from the geometry, and there's a volume term that's order 1 coming from the fields. So there's still a volume term.
And that the size of that dip doesn't go to 0 when L is much bigger than beta?
Well, if we normalize by the thermal value, it goes to 0.
Which is a fraction of the thermal value, it goes to 0.
Yes. Yeah.
You're talking about because of interactions in the bulk?
I just thought that something would fall into the black hole. You create a black hole, say it has a black hole in it, you've got some perturbations of the fields outside. Yes, they have correlations, but
that's a good point. Okay, I'm not sure exactly what happens with that. At very late times.
Yeah. Just some power law decay in that case. Or PTZ, I think. And quasi-remote node behavior. I think that's a good way of saying it. All of the bulk entanglement should dissipate as a quasi-remote node of PTZ. So it's got to go away.
What about the boundary graviton?
Except for the boundary graviton. That's the special case. But since you said free fields actually thermalize in this state, I suspect the boundary gravitons do as well.
Mm-hmm. They're conserved, so they will contribute a little something.
Okay. Yeah.
So just following up my
earlier question, if I consider a finite size circle in space, then even for a single interval, there will be a difference like this at time L over 2, around L over 2.
Yeah.
But it sounds like in that case, the calculation is like a 3-point function rather than 4-point. Whether the same phenomenon happens there.
Well, it's going to you're going to be on a more complicated surface now because you've identified. I think you'd have to worry about similar issues there, but I don't actually, I don't know what the actual answer is.
Yeah, I just still remember the, right in 1984, I think it was, where the minimal models came out, and David Hughes pointed out that there were these lattice models, which were soluble, you know, which were in, had critical points, you know, which corresponded to C as, you know, 1 minus 1 over n, or whatever the sequence of minimal models is. And just to come back to your question about these single models on a Calabi-Yau manifold, which means not very much to me, is an example of a lattice model which has a multi-critical point that one could tune to with C bigger than 1, and which has the conserved quantities other than this.
There's a model which is basically there's a supersymmetric model. Okay, it comes from a Calabi-Yau, but we don't have to ever say Calabi-Yau. It's eight bosons and 8 fermions. It has C equals 12, and that theory has a the free theory is quasi-particle like, but that theory has an exactly marginal deformation. It's controlled because of supersymmetry, and if you turn on that exactly marginal deformation, then that's an example of this. That's the simplest example I know of a controlled example I know of a theory in this class.
Well, I'm not asking about control, I'm asking about a lattice model.
A lattice, I don't know. Yeah. I think the one I just gave is a lattice model. It's just a bunch of free fields plus a deformation. So.
Well, it's adding the exactly marginal interaction. Maybe it might be hard.
I don't know.
A lot of fine tuning needed, basically.
In that case, there is. My personal bias is that probably most conformal field theories, in some sense, are probably like this, and that minimal models are special. And it's just hard to talk about the ones with C greater than 1.
Most interesting.
Yes, that's another question. That's another question.
Well, it's a beautiful class of models, all of which are individually ugly.
Okay. Maybe one last question? No. Okay.
Is it important, just qualitatively, if your physics that there be conservation laws at all? I mean, I know that in this case, you at least have energy conserved, but is it necessary?
You mean from a sort of experimental point of view, if you, or?
Oh, no, I'm just thinking that, I mean, there are other classes of systems that we study or driven systems that don't have energy conservation.
Oh.
Would you expect this in the phenomenon of the dip?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know.
Okay, with that, let's thank Tom.